watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The nation state is maintained by force and violence, whether carried out by monarchs, presidents, or parliaments, and their cops, courts, and armies. Laws and customs vary among nations, or are even contested within nations, as we covered on the program last week. But what all these nations have in common is the use of official force to maintain social relationships of unequal power and unequal access to the means for living. Ironically, these institutions of force are rationalized as crime prevention, justified to control human nature, which is portrayed as selfish and brutal and prone to cutthroat competition. But do they rather not create a culture of callousness and competition through the hierarchies they enforce that give rise to crime because so many people experience a world where others do not care and make no effort to see that their needs can be met? A society with a deficit of love is one with an excess of crime. The traditional communal cultures of America had no prisons and very little crime. Our laws create crime by establishing the conditions that make crime a reasonable survival option. Accompanied by a culture that deliberately inflames the desires for things it then withholds from many individuals. Far from being some innate condition of the human species, societies based on institutionalized inequality, money, and land ownership have only been prevalent in the last 5,000 years or so of human history. One of the problems we have in understanding the development of human culture and the path of human history and prehistory is that archaeologists, historians, and scientists have imposed upon the past interpretations and judgments rooted in their own social prejudices and presented this distorted picture as objective fact to justify self-serving ideologies. 1 in 6 people in America are officially below the poverty line. In 2004, requests for emergency food assistance increased by an average of 14% during the year, according to a 27-city study by the United States Conference of Mayors. Also in this study, it was noted that on average, 20% of requests for emergency food assistance have gone unmet. This, despite the fact that more than 350 billion pounds of food is available for human consumption in the United States. And of that total, nearly 100 billion pounds, nearly a third, are wasted or thrown away by retailers, restaurants, and consumers. In many places, laws have been passed to make it a crime to recover this wasted food from the garbage. And in all places, the laws of property allow the owner to order the arrest of any person coming onto their property to recover wasted food. Some groceries and restaurants have a policy of pouring noxious chemicals on the food they throw away in order to render it inedible. Remember that the food being thrown away by restaurants 5 minutes after closing time was for sale for full price 5 minutes before closing time and is perfectly edible. So people aren't hungry because there's no food. They are hungry because there's no money, without which they can neither buy the food nor buy the land to grow their own food. The system of money and property has been imposed on the world and created poverty where there was once plenty. In the words of an old English folk song, The law doth punish man or woman that steals the goose from off the commons, but lets the greater felon loose that steals the commons from the goose. When Columbus and his disease-ridden crew arrived in the land of the Arawaks, healthy, friendly people came to meet them and welcomed them with food and gifts. Columbus wrote in his journal how beautiful and strong they were, and noted their lack of weapons. His thought, how easily he could enslave the people and take their rich and productive land. Yet generations of children have been taught that Columbus was the civilized one, and the Arawaks were savages, that Columbus' violence and greed were just human nature, and the society of the Arawaks is just not explained. This week, we'll dig deep to debunk the notion that there is no alternative to a vicious society. Let's begin with an evolutionary perspective. What I'm going to play you first is the soundtrack of a film made in the mid-1980s by the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, titled Nice Guys Finish First, which he made in response to misunderstanding of his groundbreaking book, The Selfish Gene. The film begins with a montage of images of male animals fighting, human males yelling, and heads of state and generals in uniform.
My name is Richard Dawkins. I'm a zoologist from Oxford. Some people think I've provided the biological justification for that bleak, ruthless, competitive, selfish world, because they've completely misunderstood what's implied by a book I wrote 9 years ago called The Selfish Gene. Too many people read it by title only, and in particular, people on the extreme left and the extreme right of the political spectrum. On the right, we had various writers from the National Front and French equivalents who saw the idea of the selfish gene as chiming in very much with their own rather nasty political philosophy. They liked the idea of what they saw as a biological justification for the kind of cutthroat competitive world which they advocated. I was also approached by various right-wing American economists who were equally attracted by the idea that in the economic sphere, completely free capitalistic market economy could be justified on biological grounds. On the left, on the other hand, we had people reacting very strongly, as you might expect, to these right-wing responses. And I remember being blamed in a magazine article by one influential left-wing writer, almost personally blamed for the election of Mrs. Thatcher in the last general election. The right-wingers thought that my idea of the selfish gene always meant survival of the strongest, most competitive, most selfish. But I didn't mean to suggest that the selfish gene approach precludes cooperation. Even within this brutal red in tooth and claw encounter, there's a great deal of sophisticated social cooperation among the hyenas. These adult wildebeest are devoting valuable time and energy to protecting some other individual's baby from the marauder. Some years ago, it was popularly believed that such selfless behavior could be explained away because it was for the good of the species. The trouble is, we no longer believe that evolution can act on whole species. It's the individual that counts, and the immortality of its genes, which can only be carried to the next generation thanks to an individual's reproductive success. This sounds very selfish, each animal looking out for number one. But it isn't necessarily so. I'm going to explain how selfish genes can give rise to altruistic, cooperative behavior to stop this idea being misinterpreted. We can explain many forms of cooperation thanks to a lot of work, for instance, on the social insects. The ultimate act of altruism, a bee from one colony giving its life in a battle to the death with a marauder from another colony. But the workers of each colony are all highly genetically related to the reproductively active individuals, the young queens and drones. So this sacrifice makes sense if it will protect the colony and improve the chances of the same genes living on in future individuals. But there's a great deal of cooperation in nature where genetic relatedness cannot be the explanation, where the individuals concerned aren't even of the same species. The relationship between the clownfish and the anemone is mutually rewarding. The fish are immune to the anemone's stinging cells, so they're protected. In return, the anemone obtains scraps of food from the fish. Reciprocal altruism. You do me a favor and I'll return it. But it's not enough simply to observe that there's something in it for both. We have to explain how animals get to binding agreements, like this. The cooperation here, ants milking aphids and repaying the favor with protection, will be favored by natural selection if the selfish genes on both sides are benefiting from the association. But to explain how it comes about and remains mutual and effective, biologists have employed a concept more common to human interactions, the idea of strategy. We're all familiar with the ordinary human sense of a consciously worked out strategy for achieving some desired goal, where we actually sit down and think to ourselves, how can I best behave in order to get what I want? But evolutionary biologists use the word strategy in a rather different sense. They use it to mean a pre-wired program, rather like a computer program or a program that's controlling an unconscious robot, where the program is written not by a human programmer but by natural selection. Both these senses of strategy, the ordinary human consciously worked out strategy and the evolutionary pre-wired program strategy, have a lot in common. They share some of the same principles. Both of them are about achieving some desired goal. For years, strategic human interactions, like these games of chess, have been modeled in mathematical terms. It's called, appropriately enough, game theory. And biologists have borrowed the technique to analyze animal behavior too. Chess is so complicated, we may never work out the infallible winning strategy. But we do know that the object of the game is to win. Each player carries around with him a mental baggage of offensive and defensive moves he can employ at any given point in the game. If neither player ends up winning, it won't signify an agreement between them to cooperate, simply a stalemate. The trouble is, far too many of us see life in both the human and animal world in terms of competitive games like this, where if black is winning, white must lose. Checkmate. The idea of football being anything else but competitive is ludicrous. It just wouldn't be football. The whole game is constructed in order to reward one team for sticking the ball in the other team's net. And the payoffs reinforce that. 3 points for a win, only one for a draw, and nothing for the losers. But although the framework is competitive, decisions as to whether to compete or not are made inside human heads. They can make nonsense of the whole idea of the game. It happened back in 1977 in the English First Division. The match was between Coventry City and Bristol City, and both teams were fighting to stay up in the next season. The bottom of the table looked like this. Tottenham and Stoke were already relegated. One of the other three had to join them. Sunderland, who were playing their last game at Everton, would stay up on goal difference, even if they lost, providing there was a loser at Coventry. Coventry and Bristol played the game like a cup tie. Into the second half, and Coventry were already two up. Bristol looked doomed. But late in the game, they fought back. 2-2. The Coventry-Bristol game was running 5 minutes late, so at that point, news came through that Sunderland had lost. The Coventry manager had the Everton-Sunderland result flashed up on the electronic scoreboard. Now both Coventry and Bristol were saved, if only they could keep their score 2-2. The game turned into something like this. Farcical football. The side in possession made no attempt to score. To do so was to invite retaliation. In reply, the other side amiably shadowed them for the rest of the game. The players had decided, consciously, to cooperate, not compete. And the draw was not stalemate, but the cooperative solution. In this case, it was easy for the players to know when to switch from conflict to cooperation. But there is a particular game which we're going to explore where the possibility of mixing conflict and cooperation presents a real dilemma.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for...
A psychologist, Dr. Andrew Coleman, and these sixth formers are going to play that game. The amounts of pound coins are deliberately fixed to present a dilemma between trusting cooperation and individual selfishness.
There are no right or wrong answers.
It's a game that's become famous because it's thought to represent a great many social interactions in real life.
You make a decision at the same time, and the outcome depends on the decision.
It's called the prisoner's dilemma.
There's no trickery in this experiment. Everything that we tell you is perfectly true. There's no trickery involved. And furthermore, there will be no likelihood of you being humiliated or made to look silly or anything like that. It's a simple, straightforward task exactly the way it's presented to you.
Okay, you've got a choice now between...
The experimental setup explains why. Anil and Adrian are like two prisoners locked in different cells.
When you made your decision not to meet...
They've got to make a choice whether to cooperate with each other or defect. Play C or D, just once. But they can't signal to each other and the barrier prevents all contact. Okay. They're not particularly close friends either. So they've got no prior reason to trust each other.
I'm going to say ready, steady, go. When I say go, write down your choice on the pad in front of you. Ready, steady, go. Right, thank you very much. Now, what has in fact happened is that Adrian has chosen C and Anil has chosen D, so that Adrian gets only £1, Anil gets £4. Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions about this. First of all, obviously, I must turn to Adrian. You only got £1 out of this. How do you feel about it?
Not too pleased. I worked on the basis of the largest amount in the columns.
Uh-huh. And what was the largest amount you were hoping to get?
I worked on the three. I thought that if the total added up together was greater than the decomp.
Adrian's worked out that the highest joint score is 3 plus 3, 6, a high reward for mutual cooperation. But he's trusted Anil to see it that way too.
So are you sorry about the way things have turned out?
Yes.
I mean, if you'd known he was going to do that, what would you have done?
I would have chosen the same one.
You'd have chosen the same as he did, which is D. And what do you feel, Anil, about this now? Are you surprised at the outcome?
I'm pleased about it. I gave £4.
You're pleased, I'm sure you are. Are you surprised at all? Did you expect him to choose, Adrian to choose C?
No, not really. I just chose D because the four seems to stand out.
It stands out in what way?
The four just seems to be more bold than all the other numbers.
What's the highest number? But, I mean, it's printed in exactly the same letters.
Anil has discovered that it's possible to get even higher than three by riding on the back of Adrian's cooperative instincts and defecting or cheating himself.
Opportunity to do this again, you'd presumably...
And Anil, by his selfish action, ironically, has made Adrian a sucker with only 1 point because Adrian's cooperative move has led to him being taken for a ride.
Well, if you did choose D again, and you said if you did it again, you'd choose D, then you both have been choosing D and you'd both get two. Would you be happy with that, Adrian, if you both got two?
Yes, it's an improvement on the previous one.
Anita, you're choosing between the red C and the red D, that's between the rows. And Michelle, you're choosing between the columns, the blue C and the D. Try to choose as well as you possibly can. When you've made your decision, you indicate your decision by writing a C or a D on the pad in front of you. And when you've both made your decisions, I'll announce the result and you'll get paid. Okay, think about it, take your time, and then make your decisions.
Well, just decide. There's no question, I don't think I have.
You decide, and depending on which decision you make, you get the appropriate payoffs. Okay, you've both made your decisions. Anita, Michelle, you've both chosen D.
In fact, in this one-off encounter, defecting is always the dominant strategy.
Are you happy with the decision that you've made, Anita?
Yes.
And you're happy with the outcome?
Yes, quite happy.
You're going to get £2.
Yeah.
You're each going to get £2. Are you happy with that as well? Now, you could each have got £3 if you'd each chosen C, couldn't you?
Yeah.
So, what do you mean when you say you're happy about it? Wouldn't you have rather had both choose C?
I think a little bit, yes.
So do you regret choosing D?
No, I was banking on her choosing C, actually.
You chose D because you were banking on her choosing C, so you wanted
to... It's a gamble, yes.
If one defects, the best thing the other can do is defect as well. And if one player cooperates, defecting is still the best move.
Well, I felt that she might choose D as well, and there was more chance of her choosing a D for some reason than a C.
You thought there was more chance that she'd choose a D?
D, yes.
So you chose a D to protect yourself, so to speak?
This is the dilemma. Because both do reason like that, they both end up with only 2 points. If they'd illogically trusted each other, they'd have got more. Selfishness has robbed them and won the day.
Yes, but I was hoping that she'd pick the C, so I'd get 4.
So you were going for the top prize.
If you go to a restaurant on your own, then you have exactly what you want, and you pay exactly what you want. But we've all had the experience of going to a restaurant in a gang of 10, say, and agreeing in advance that we're going to split the bill. You know what happens then? There's always somebody who has the most expensive dish on the menu or has an extra pint of lager. And the reason he does it is that he knows that the extra expense is going to be shared among the 10 of them. He gets the benefit. We all pay the costs. Now, this doesn't sound like a very serious example, but it does have its serious side in the real world, and it's been given the name, the tragedy of the commons. Now, it so happens that in Oxford, we've got a real tragedy of the commons on our own doorstep in the well-known meadow called Port Meadow. Doesn't look like too much of a tragedy, does it? But I can assure you that ecologically speaking, we really do have the makings of a tragedy here. This is ragwort. It's a poisonous plant and cattle won't eat it. And it's an indicator species of overgrazing. The same is true of thistles. Where you get ragwort and thistles, that tends to mean overgrazing. And for the past 15 years, the ragwort and thistles have been steadily taking over this meadow as there's been an increasing overgrazing problem.
14, John, if you like.
The sheriff's man taking control at the great annual Port Meadow roundup. He's descended out of the blue to try and stop that overgrazing by catching out any commoner who's grazing more animals than he's entitled to. But his efforts may be wasted because of a problem which is of the city government's own making. 15 years ago, they asked each commoner how many animals he would like legal rights to graze on this common land.
Let's all get in the corner.
Naturally, each of them, being human, submitted his own selfish estimate of the most he could possibly want.
What about this Frisian here? Is this yours here, this one?
Along the fence. Go on.
All those bids got accepted. So even if each farmer is only grazing what he's legally entitled to, there's a huge overcrowding problem. Because when you tot all those figures up, it's enormous. Some 1,000 horses, 6 donkeys, over 1,000 geese, and 2,000 cattle. Far more than the commons can support. If one farmer owned all this land, it wouldn't happen. He'd make a rational decision, so he wouldn't underuse it, and he wouldn't overgraze it either. But as it's common land, it's beyond individual restraint. Because whatever everyone else does, each individual is better off being selfish. If everyone else keeps on overgrazing, what's the point in me reducing my herd? And if everyone else cuts back their animals, my continuing to be selfish won't ruin the commons. Everyone is playing the prisoner's dilemma, so they all reason selfishly, and the common ends up ruined. The American biologist Garrett Hardin uses this idea of the tragedy of the commons as a microcosm of how we humans, from wealthy Oxford to struggling Ethiopia, are gradually ruining our biggest resource, the earth.
These two choices are not the whole story. If the farmers were able to manage the land cooperatively, they could employ strategies to graze in alternate portions of the meadow each season. But this begs the question of why so many farmers, with so many animals, apparently have only the one meadow in which to graze. They are being prevented from using other meadows. As we heard on the show a few weeks ago, the Haudenosaunee manage their land so well that they appear to the Europeans as wilderness. In order to prevent the land from being overfarmed and overhunted, they periodically relocated their villages, allowing the prior site to regenerate naturally. They could do this because they had the run of their territory, which was of adequate size to support their population. It's not a tragedy of the commons. It's a tragedy of land enclosure that leaves a pittance to the commons, that steals the commons from the goose.
Critical population of birds which suffers from parasitizing by a tick, which carries a dangerous disease. So it's very desirable for these birds that they get the ticks off. And they can pull them off themselves over most of their body, but they can't reach the top of their head. The only way they can get the ticks off there is to cooperate with each other. They must pull each other's ticks off. Now, pulling ticks off is not entirely free. It costs a certain amount of energy and time. And therefore, although cooperating is a desirable thing for both birds to do because they both get rid of their ticks, if one of them could get away with having his ticks pulled off but not reciprocating by pulling the ticks off the other one, then he would do even better. And we're starting to piece together a prisoner's dilemma. In other words, mutual grooming would be very rewarding, but getting groomed and refusing to groom back is cheating, and better still. If both defect by not grooming at all, it's less rewarding because no one's getting rid of parasites. And grooming everyone else and never getting groomed yourself makes you the sucker. Cheats always refuse to repay the favor of a tick being removed. So they go around and they get their ticks removed by suckers, but they never pay it back. The suckers, on the other hand, go around removing ticks from other individuals. And whenever they meet a cheat, they pay the cost of removing the tick, but they don't get any of the benefit. So obviously the cheats are going to do better than the suckers because they get their ticks removed and they don't pay the cost. The suckers get their ticks removed only when they meet another sucker. When they meet a cheat, they pay the cost of removing a tick, but they don't get the benefit. So if the world were confined just to cheats and suckers, there's no doubt what would happen. The cheats would drive the suckers extinct. But the cheat's success might be short-lived. The parasites might then drive them extinct as well. What we need is an animal which would make cooperation a stable outcome. So I invented one and called it the grudger. What the grudgers do is they behave like suckers in that they go around removing ticks from other individuals. But every time they meet an individual who in the past has refused to do them a favor, they bear a grudge, they remember, and they refused to remove his ticks. Now, in a world which consists of cheats, suckers, and grudgers, provided only there are enough grudgers to start with, it's easy to show that the grudgers will be the most successful and will eventually drive both the cheats and the suckers extinct. So in this world of cheats, suckers, and grudgers, grudgers are the most successful. But that's just three strategies. Mightn't there be something better we could imagine that would do even better than the grudgers?
Right, now you both know what the rules are, Adrian, Anita.
We invited Anita and Adrian back to play the prisoner's dilemma game. This time, repeating the game an indefinite number of times. More like a relationship in real life.
No. Adrian chose D, Anita chose D, so Adrian gets 2 points, Anita gets 2 points.
Could they use the successive moves to build up a mutual strategy for cooperation, not defection, and profit by it?
Right, make your second choice now. Adrian chose D, Anita chose D.
But it's a bad start, mutual defection.
Right, think about your third choice, and when you're ready, let me know. Right, make your third choice now. Adrian chose C, Anita chose D. So Adrian gets 1, Anita gets 4.
At last, a cooperative signal from Adrian. What will they do with it?
Next choice, now. Adrian chose D. Anita chose D. 2 points each.
No response from Anita. And Adrian has fallen back to defecting too.
Choice. Next choice, now. Adrian chose D. Anita chose D. 2 points each. All right, ready for your next choice? Right, make a choice now. Adrian chose D. Anita chose D. 2 points each.
They've got locked into mutual defection.
Now. Adrian chose C. Anita chose D. Adrian gets 1, Anita gets 4.
Adrian signaled again, but no luck. It's as if he were relying on telepathy.
Now. Adrian chose D. Anita chose D. 2 points each. Ready for the next one?
The game carried on like that for 3 more rounds of mutual defection.
Ready for the next pair of choices?
Until?
Right. Now. Adrian chose D. Anita chose C. Adrian gets 4. Anita gets 1. And that is the end of this particular series, I can tell you. So that if we add it up, Adrian has in fact got 24 points. Anita's got 27. So that's £2.40 for you, £2.70 for you.
If they'd got off to a good cooperative start, they could have won over £3 each. But Adrian's overtures had produced no harmony.
First, I decided that I'd let him do 2 C's in a row to indicate to me that he wanted to cooperate and for both of us to do C's. I thought that if he does a C and I do a D, he's bound to retaliate by doing a D.
Oh, yes.
And he didn't. Well, he did, rather. And so that's why I did a D.
That's
after
right.
He did a C. Right at the end, I decided to change my mind. I thought, well, maybe I should take the lead and indicate to him that maybe we should cooperate, but unfortunately he stopped us.
You didn't have time to do it. What about you, Adrian? How did you approach this?
I was working on much the same thing, whereas just for the first time I picked D because it's the sort of a no-lose situation. You've always come away with a minimum of 2 and a maximum of 4. And then put a C in, hoping that she would gather that I was going for that and going for three each time, as opposed to going for a D every time. Which
you got clobbered when you went for a C, didn't you?
Yes, that's why I avoided them in the end. I'd sort of interspersed a C with the Ds every so often.
And whenever you did it, you got the sucker's payoff.
I was hoping that she would see that that's what I was doing, approaching, going for two Cs, but because I got what you call the sucker's penalty, I wasn't willing to do another C, two Cs in a row, which she said she was waiting for.
You didn't do a C next time round. When you first did a C, the second thing you did was a D, and that's what I thought you'd do.
She was
so I thought, why should I be a sucker and do a C and just end up with a pound? That's why I did a D.
I was doing the same thing. Because you chose a D, I wasn't willing to risk losing the game. Then when we got to the end, I think we'd both clicked what the other was trying to do.
And it was too late.
Yeah, I was ready to go for another C next time.
What's needed is a pre-planned system for getting cooperation going and maximising winnings. Now, is there any way we can work out in advance what the best strategy is? Computers can be programmed to do anything you like, and that includes playing the game of Prisoner's Dilemma. All you have to do is to feed in the right program. One program for playing the game, another program for playing the game, and they can play against each other. But that's just two programs. We need to increase the number of programs that we play against each other in order to find which is the one that will succeed best against all comers. And that was the idea that occurred to an American political scientist, Robert Axelrod. He advertised in a learned journal and invited professors, experts in game theory, to submit programs that they thought embodied the best strategy they could think of for playing the game. He then gathered together all these programs for playing Prisoner's Dilemma, played them off against each other in a computer to see which would win. In other words, he organized a computer tournament. He got altogether 14 entrants, all sent to him as computer software. This one was especially interesting to me, Friedman. It was just like my grudger. Cooperative to start off with, but a permanent retaliator once cheated against. Although this program appeared cooperative, it wasn't. It kept trying to sneak in with the occasional out-of-the-blue defection. And Downing relied on its cleverness, constantly updating the statistical chances of cooperation or defection from its opponent. But it always started pessimistically, assuming the other player was going to defect. And the simplest program of all, tit for tat. It started with a nice cooperative move and thereafter simply copied what its opponent's last move was, playing a C for a C and a D for a D. Nice means never the first to defect. The computer played them all off against each other. When the results came out, he got a surprise. Tit for tat, the simplest program, had proved the best. Axelrod published his analysis of tit for tat's properties, thereby giving the program as a target to aim at in a second round of the competition. About half of them reasoned that if tit for tat had won because it was nice, they might do even better by writing programs that were even nicer, or at least as nice. The other half reasoned that there would be lots of nice strategies submitted, and therefore there were rich pickings to be had by exploiting them. But when those results were revealed, tit for tat had won again, and the full list showed several things that were also thought-provoking. Of the first 15 programs home, only one, Harrington, at number 8, was a nasty, exploitative strategy. All the rest were fundamentally cooperative. Niceness continued to dominate the ranking. The nasty programs are outlined in green. But it clearly didn't pay to be too nice. Tit for two tats, for instance, at 24, didn't do nearly as well as tit for tat. Even that small amount of leniency was too easily exploited. And as we come to the bottom of the heap, we find all the nasty strategies. They all score badly, because eventually they have to play against each other. Crime doesn't pay in this game. Why was tit for tat so astonishingly successful? Firstly, tit for tat is nice. It's never the first to defect. Now, this came as quite a surprise to some of the experts who sent in programs, because they had imagined that the way to succeed in this game was to make subtle opening moves of defection. Secondly, tit for tat is not envious. It doesn't measure its success by how well it's doing against its immediate opponent, but by its total winnings at the end of the competition. Tit for tat, in fact, cannot win in an individual game against an opponent. It can only do at least as well. And tit for tat does well only when its opponent is doing well too. It's fundamentally a cooperative strategy. Thirdly, tit for tat is a forgiving strategy. It forgives as swiftly as it retaliates. And fourthly, it's simple, easy to read, uncomplicated.
Ready for the next pair of choices?
So if they had been playing tit for tat, both Anita and Adrian would have opened with a C instead of a D. They'd have got a good start.
3 points each.
But if Anita had decided to defect, as she did before, Adrian should follow suit, playing D, only changing back to C if Anita repented and started playing C again. Tit for tat and other nice strategies like it succeed because they have a sufficient expectation of meeting other nice strategies like themselves. If there were a population in which there was only a single tit for tat or only a single nice strategy and all the rest were nasty cheats, say, then there's no chance for the tit for tat or the nice strategy to spread through the population in the evolutionary manner. This is because it never meets another one like itself and therefore cannot benefit by mutual cooperation. There has to be an initial critical number, a critical mass of nice strategies that have to get together before they can take off in the evolutionary sense. Let's allow them to interact for a while, playing the prisoner's dilemma game. When two cheats meet, we know there's no chance of cooperation. And in a meeting between tit for tat and a cheat, because it's initially prepared to be nice, tit for tat will come off marginally worse. But when tit for tatters meet each other, they play cooperatively and stack up the points. Evidence for animals actually playing tit for tat is still faint, but there are examples. The best documented is the vampire bat, because these blood suckers can become blood donors. Every night, the adult bats forage for a meal of blood, but not all of them successfully find a victim. Many will return to the bat cave hungry. We know that bats mutually groom each other. They are reciprocal altruists. It's now been shown that bats will share their blood meal with hungry bats, but only with individuals with whom they've built up a blood-sharing relationship. They're discriminating tit-for-tat bats. On a coral reef, cleaner fish have their business premises. The customers recognize the barber shop and form a placid, orderly queue outside. These fixed meeting places substitute for the barber and his client actually recognizing each other and bring the players together so tit-for-tat mutualism can evolve. Obviously, there's a temptation to cheat, get groomed and finish off with a tasty snack. But nature can retaliate. Experimenters remove cleaner fish from a section of the reef, simulating their extinction. In no time at all, the predators became covered with infections and began looking very dog-eared. On the reef, cheating doesn't pay. Sites like this are simply unknown in the open sea because both players could only ever meet each other once anyway. A dramatic reconstruction of the First World War. Official history paints this picture too. But it wasn't always like this. The First World War is the last place where you'd expect to find cooperation between opposing armies. And yet that's exactly what happened. Non-aggression pacts, cooperation, broke out like a disease, that's how the general saw it, all up and down the front lines. And the special feature of this trench warfare that made tit-for-tat possible was the very fact that it was entrenched. In 1915, the war in the trenches got quite literally bogged down. Informal verbal truces were often arranged to effect repairs. These English soldiers are quite openly repairing the breastwork of their trench in no man's land. The German line is just under this row of trees. The most poignant of those early truces occurred at Christmas 1915. Such overt truces were too easily spotted and squashed. So the warfare became ritualized. To an outside observer, these cannonades always looked deadly. But sometimes they were aimed to fall out of harm's way. They were signaling peace. Snipers could shoot to miss as easily as they could aim to hit. And machine gunners sometimes elected to fire high and wide. This benign warfare was understood and reciprocated by the other side. Sharpshooters on both sides often demonstrated their prowess with feats of target practice over each other's heads. They were showing their ability to punish truce-breaking severely. Live and let live was winning out over get them before they get you. It allowed countless soldiers on both sides very long periods of peaceful coexistence where they could try and make the best of a bad lot.
And when they ask us how dangerous it was, oh, we'll never tell them, oh, we'll never tell them. We spent our pay in some cafe and fought while with it. Was the cushiest job we ever had. And when they ask us, and they're certainly going to ask us, the reason why we didn't win the quad again. Oh.
Suddenly a salvo arrived, but did no damage. Naturally, both sides got down, and our men started swearing at the Germans. When all at once, a brave German got onto his parapet and shouted, "We are very sorry about that. We hope no one is hurt. It's not our fault. It's that damned Prussian artillery."
Such accidents demanded rapid apology and rapid forgiveness. They were piecing together tit for tat.
There was a front, a damned
This live-and-let-live system was so rampant and effective precisely because the principles that we've seen make tit-for-tat such a robust strategy happened to be observed. The opening moves were nice ones. Retaliation was swift and effective. Forgiveness of mistaken transgressions of the truce was equally swift and dependable. And both sides knew that they were going to be facing each other across no man's land for a very long time. The disease of peace was so rampant during the first 2 years of the war that the generals had to act. They rewrote their battle tactics to place the emphasis on random, sporadic raids. Nothing could be more calculated to spoil the trust tit-for-tat had built up. Today we're bogged down in another war, a Cold War, looking to these two men to get us out of it. For decades, the military and diplomatic advice which has underpinned the superpowers' policies has been dominated by win or lose, competitive thinking. But there's faint evidence that some strategists are beginning to think about more cooperative strategies, like tit for tat. In a search for a game, both sides can win. Defense experts, arms race negotiators, don't need to be told of the value of provocability. That, after all, is what deterrence is all about. But they might be surprised to learn of the value of initial niceness and subsequent forgivingness as recipes for a stable relationship. Of course, there's a great deal of cooperation in human society. A city like Oxford, for instance, could never have been built or maintained without huge amounts of cooperation between its inhabitants over centuries. And we do it naturally, of our free will, without having to be forced into it. But is our cooperation to do with our ability to think deeply, rationally, and philosophically? Or have our brains evolved as advanced social organs designed to police tit-for-tat reciprocity, to calculate past favours, balance debts? An organ of social calculation, designed to make us angry when we feel we've been cheated, and guilty when we know we are the cheat. The American biologist Garrett Hardin, who coined the phrase the tragedy of the commons, also coined another memorable phrase, nice guys finish last. And he coined it as a way of summing up his understanding of the selfish gene view of life. But now that we've travelled through the story of tit for tat, we might perhaps be forgiven for amending his phrase to nice guys finish first. And that such insights should come from a computer tournament has led one eminent biologist to remark that this is not artificial intelligence, it just may be the real thing.
And you've been listening to the soundtrack of Nice Guys Finish First, a film with Richard Dawkins made in the mid-1980s during the Thatcher government in Britain. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
I'm asking you, big guys, what do the dead say? Did all those guys die thinking of democracy and freedom and liberty and honor? You know they didn't.
We need a do it right now philosophy. It's already too late philosophy. social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. You can't deny that. Together.
And that was Kung Flute by the band Havana Guard, based in Hamburg. Sent to us by Ian Bennett, one of the band members who listens to this show. Thanks, Ian. Havana Guard has a MySpace page at myspace.com/HavanaGuard, spelled HavanaGuard. The original human societies were based on mutual support and on the extended family, all for one and one for all. The Diné say of a person who amasses a huge herd of sheep when others have none, that he loves sheep more than he loves his family. In our society, this sheep amasser is held up as a role model. In their society, he is determined to have a spiritual illness that is separating him from beauty, a sense of appropriate and balanced priorities, from the ability to love properly. Surveying the multi-tiered disaster that is our society, some people are returning to the ancient ways of the species and asking how these values could be brought to the present. They have identified money and the social relationships that accompany it as the root of the evil. In 2004, a group of feminist thinkers from all over the world met to consider the theory of the gift economy, the elimination of money and hierarchy that have been imposed by force and violence on the world. The conference was organized by Genevieve Vaughan, author of For Giving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange. The conference was recorded by Frieda Worden of the Women's International News Gathering Service. I've played some of these presentations on the show in the past, and I'd like to offer you one more. Our next speaker is Dr. Claudia von Verhelhoff, Professor of Women's Studies and Political Science at the University of Innsbruck, Austria. Professor von Verhelhoff recently had an article, No Critique of Capitalism Without a Critique of Patriarchy, Why the Left is No Alternative, published in the March 2007 issue of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism.
I met Jen last year in Luxembourg when there was the first World Congress of Matriarchal Studies, and she gave me her book. And I must say, I am really deeply impressed by this book, Forgiving, because of the clarity and depth of her analysis of a person who speaks out of her whole life experience and reflection, a mixture of being mother, a lover, a very good thinker, everything together. And I was really deeply impressed, and I think this is exactly what we needed at the moment, this deep analysis of our situation. Now, when I heard Jeanette Armstrong just before the break, I felt ashamed of having done so little compared to the size of the problem, because we don't know where the exit is. We didn't prevent patriarchy from developing so far, we women. And so I think this is... we have to do that now.